Welcome, everybody. My name is Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Very excited to be speaking this next half hour with Professor John Hall of UW-Madison. He is the Ambrose Heseltine Professor of U.S. Military History, and he focuses on how societies use organized violence, military violence, if you will, to pursue and defend their interests. We're going to get in maybe to a little bit about what's been said and is going on with those boats in the Caribbean, but I want to start at a very basic level, John. In the United States, we have had a tradition of civilian control of the military and a norm that the military has always, in its inception and in the manner that it executes its duties and fulfills each individual service member's oaths to the Constitution, that it should be in all matters apolitical. How do you think we're faring under this current administration in maintaining those critically important standards?
Well, I think that it is doing a creditable job so far. So not without exceptions to that, but I think the longer that people have been in the American Professional Arms, the better that they have absorbed and internalized this professional military ethic, which, as you indicate, I mean, dates to very early American history. And this was in evidence when the Secretary of Defense and the President addressed the senior leaders of the U.S. military, won stars and up in command billets and along with their senior enlisted leaders. You could see that crowd was abiding by that professional military ethic. You can see it every year when presidents give the State of the Union address and you have the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the other Joint Chiefs sitting there in the front row with their hands on their laps, looking stoic, not smiling, not applauding. And that is what the Constitution doesn't explicitly call for that, but that is what the norm in this country calls for. It is worth pointing out, though, that the ideal of an apolitical military has not always been the fact. Back to the founding of the Republic, it was the case that the first two political parties in this country, the Federalists and the Jeffersonian Republicans, predecessors to today's modern Democratic Party, the army of that era was overwhelmingly Federalist. It's persuasion. And there have been other times. There's that is between what your individual political beliefs are and whether or not that actually influences.
John, I'm going to jump in. We're having a little bit of trouble hearing you, so I'm going to suggest that you give us a call directly. If you look in the studio chat, we've got the direct line to our studio so that you can call in. And I wanted to help clarify a little bit about what the professor was saying. Of course, I pointed to and have pointed to multiple times on this program that what Mr. Hegseth was saying to military leadership was not apolitical. What Donald Trump said to military leadership at Quantico was not apolitical. That they're missing that, right? But what John is saying is when you looked at that room, what you saw was that the military commanders themselves were not responding, either an affirmation or an objection to the politicized statements being made by those various folks, whether that was Defense Secretary Hegseth or Donald Trump in that moment. Welcome back, John. Thanks for calling in. Just want you to reset a little bit. And I was sharing with folks what you were explaining before it got a little spotty there, was that when you look at the Quantico speeches given by Secretary of Defense Hegseth and President Trump, when you looked at the military leadership in that room and you referenced the State of the Union addresses, they don't applaud. They basically are non-reactive. That is the symbolic embodiment of this apolitical civilian-led military that you and I are talking about here, that they are effectively non-reactive to statements that are highly politicized. And we saw that in that Quantico meeting. If there was a silver lining in the meeting, I would suggest respectfully that it was we saw those one stars and above, those generals not reacting to highly politicized or partisan statements.
Right. That's exactly the case. So you have seen other spectacles, though, in the second administration. So shortly before the Army's birthday parade in Washington, D.C., which some people allege was also a presidential birthday parade, but not long before that, the president went to Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and used a bunch of soldiers from Fort Bragg as a backdrop there. And when you're dealing with junior enlisted soldiers, they don't receive the same kind of education, right? I mean, they're yes. not yet fully incorporated into the profession of arms. Yeah. And most of the reporting at the time also indicated that the people who participated in what was, for all intents and purposes, a rally, were screened based upon their fondness for this particular commander-in-chief and his policies. And so that was, I think, the counterpoint to the display of professionalism that you saw at Quantico. I would not say that this is a, you know, display of unprofessionalism on the part of the soldiers of the 82nd Airborne Division, but I mean, it was a select crowd that arguably did not know better. Unfortunately, I think that gave the Army a black eye, gave Fort Bragg a black eye, because all of the people that were present there should have been reminded about the imperative of appearing apolitical. And so the president's more recent public appearance with a lot of junior enlisted from the U.S. Navy at an event celebrating the Navy's birthday, there you had all ranks, but again, the response to what were sort of kind of campaign rally provocations did not receive the same warm responses that they got at Fort Bragg.
Yeah, as a person spends increasing amount of time and certainly, you know, becomes in a leader in the military, the criticalness, the centrality of that fundamental apolitical nature of the military becomes much more part of your day-to-day, the ephemera, the air you breathe. It is truly internalized. Our youngest soldiers and fighters aren't quite there yet, as you so rightly explained. I wanted to ask you your thoughts, having, as an expert in military history, this we've seen just in the last 2 weeks, two extraordinary resignations. Admiral Alvin Halsey, 37 years, resigned his job as the head of the U.S. Southern Command right at the time that the U.S. under Donald Trump is mobilizing some 10,000 plus troops. There have been these missile attacks on boats. There seems to be rumblings of some kind of declaration of war, perhaps with Venezuela, yet Congress hasn't really been briefed. It's this vague area. There was reporting that he resigned after those 37 years because he was incredibly uncomfortable about those missions and those attacks and the legal basis on which they stand. In addition, the day of that Quantico presentation, September 30th, Marine Colonel Doug Krugman resigned after 24 years, wrote a scathing piece in the Washington Post. You can deal with either or both of those resignations. Are we seeing indications? Of course, Colonel Krugman's was quite public. Less public was Admiral Halsey's, though his resignation was reported. Are there indications that there are senior members of our military, regardless of branch, that are getting increasingly uncomfortable with some of these efforts to overtly politicize the military?
Well, I think undoubtedly there's tremendous discomfort. So the senior leaders of the military had already obviously dealt with this commander-in-chief for 4 years under his first administration, and it posed unique challenges in civil-military relations at the time. 2017, there was a meeting in the tank, the meeting room in the Pentagon where the senior leaders meet with the president. Widely reported, the Washington Post, a couple of books have mentioned this meeting in which senior leaders tried to, you know, convince President Trump of the benefits of the international rules-based system that the United States helped engineer after World War II, and of which the United States remains to this day the primary beneficiary. And the president would not have it, because it was an orthodoxy, a bipartisan orthodoxy post-World War II, that is utterly anathema to President Trump's worldview. And he let them know as much. And so this, you know, from that early day, I think senior leadership was kind of on a back foot, because it was a challenge to fundamental truths and a vision of the world and America's place in the world and a strategic center of gravity or alliances and so forth. And so military leaders have the right as citizens to vote, and they have an obligation then that whomever wins the election and the electoral college and is the lawful constitutional commander-in-chief, and they've got to obey those orders, but not irrespective of individual officers' votes. I have to believe that the Pentagon was sort of bracing for impact when they learned that a second Trump administration was coming in. And granted, I'm talking about the uppermost sort of tiers of leadership, yes, which includes civilian leadership in the departments of the different services and the Department of Defense. But everybody sort of knew what was probably going to come, and that was a president who had 4 years to figure out how to overcome the frustrations of the first 4 years. And that meant something of a temple cleansing. And so you've seen him move very, very quickly to effect this temple cleansing. And at Quantico, when the Secretary of Defense tells everybody, if you don't like what you're hearing, do the honorable thing and walk, I think they would like nothing better than that. I think that both President and the Secretary of Defense, when they looked out at the room, they were looking out at a corporate body that they had learned to distrust. And I think that they would probably be happy if a great, great many of the people who were in that room submitted their resignations or retired. The difference between the Marine colonel who you referenced, who yes, you know, publicly stated his reasons for doing this, and you know, published them for a national media audience, and the senior most officers who are retiring prematurely, is that we don't know in every instance if these senior officers were being compelled to right, retire prematurely before their terms are up. In their training in civil interrelations, most of them are taught that it is dangerous for them to resign in protest, that amounts to an act of civil military disobedience, because they're constitutionally legal commanders have the authority to tell them to do what they want to do.
And when we come back, we're going to continue this. We've got to take care of a couple messages. We're with Professor John Hall, a military historian. We're going to continue to dig into civil-military relations, as well as the National Guard deployments and the weird legal limbo that we collectively as Americans find ourselves in. Don't go anywhere. This critically important discussion continues on the other side. Might the National Guard be coming to this state, and what do we make of that? Next, right here on the Civic Media Radio Network.